Hello and welcome to The Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. Hello friends. I have the honour of hosting a very special guest for this episode, John Lamb Lash. Some of you will know John's work, but for those of you who don't, allow me to introduce him. John is a renowned author, comparative mythologist and teacher, known primarily for his work on Gnosticism. His book, Not in His Image, newly available as an updated 15th anniversary edition, uncovers a forgotten cosmology which many across the world have since been fascinated by, myself included. Also joining us is our mutual friend, Rob Miller. Those of you who've been following the Fergan for a while may have heard he and I in conversation before. Rob is the mastermind behind the metal band Tau Cross and formerly of legendary punk metal band Amoebix. He's a lifelong seeker of the mysteries and well-versed in Gnostic and esoteric lore. I don't think it's cavalier of me to say that you're about to hear an important discussion. John, Rob and myself spoke off the record recently and identified a tragically neglected area of discourse, the fundamental correlations between paganism and Gnosticism. Contrary to the popular view of the Gnostics as a heretical offshoot of Christianity, John Lamb Lash sees them as belonging to an original pre-Christian European shamanic tradition. John, it's an honour to be speaking with you. How are you today?
I'm quite fine, thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Excellent. I've been very much looking forward to this conversation, and those who followed the Fergan will be familiar with your name because of the videos and also the conversations that myself and our other participant tonight, Rob, have had in the past where we have referenced your name and your work. And Rob, we've had some very positive feedback on our past conversations. So how are you doing?
Dan, very well here. Thank you. And really pleased and honoured to be in such illustrious company this evening. So looking forward to see what we can wring out of this.
Yeah, me too. So following on from the introduction there, I think a good opening topic would be most people listening to this, who many of whom will be of the pagan faith or tradition themselves, they know Gnosticism as world renouncing, and as far as they know, it's not compatible with the life affirming tenets of paganism. So, John, would you mind just speaking to that a bit? Perhaps, you know, if you bear in mind that many of the listeners won't be familiar at all with Gnosticism or your work on Gnosticism. So, if you feel like giving a brief or, you know, as brief as possible introduction to your interpretation of Gnosticism. And then perhaps we can talk a little bit about how Gnosticism isn't world-renouncing as many believe it to be.
Well, yes, that's an excellent place to start. And I would say it's the necessary place to start due to the very great fact that the profile of Gnosticism and Gnostics in the entire phenomenon of antiquity that comes into the world today that reaches most people is contaminated. It doesn't represent who the Gnostics were. It doesn't represent the mysteries accurately. And you are absolutely right. You use the word world renouncing. Scholars use the word anti-cosmic in their scholarly jargon. And that's the way of saying that in their interpretation of what the Gnostics believed or knew, the Gnostics took this radical stand that they were against the world, that they considered this world we live in to be sort of a matrix or a trap for the divine spark, and that matter itself was evil, and this world has been created by the demiurge, which is in some respect not a genuine deity. That profile, that portrait that I just summarized in a few sentences is a terrible deterrent for people to come in and investigate and learn the true character of the Gnostics and the value of their message today. You see, that profile of the Gnostics is the disinformation that comes from the early Christian fathers, the Christian ideologues, who hated them. And there was a battle in the early centuries of the Common Era in which the enemies of the mysteries, which is an age-old tradition going back to the shamanic roots of the Aryan Celtic peoples, was demonized. And so, unfortunately, unless people encounter my book first, which gives them an alternative view of the origin and purpose of Gnosticism, they're going to run into that profile. And that's going to leave them with the impression that Gnosticism could not possibly have anything to do with a nature-worshipping, earth-loving perspective. Very unfortunate.
Yes. The reason that your work has resonated so strongly with me when I first came across it, nearly 10 years ago now, was precisely because of this point. My understanding or my misunderstanding had been that Gnosticism is world renouncing. Actually, my only real meeting with Gnostic ideas prior to reading Not in His Image was via a movement that's actually prevalent within the extreme metal scene called anti-Gnostic, anti-cosmic Luciferianism. So it's interesting that you mentioned the word anti-cosmic there.
Yeah.
And the way that Gnosticism is presented within this movement is to say that, yes, Yahweh or Jehovah is the false evil demiurge, and actually the Lucifer who dwells beyond the cosmos is our true creator, imbuing us with the divine spark. So you can understand that coming from that perspective to reading your book was quite a leap. And I imagine many of those listening to this will probably be similarly confused as to how these two almost opposite ideas can reconcile with one another.
Well, you know, one way to understand it, and this is a problem that has existed for centuries, as I say in my book, there is no system of philosophy or thought and no narrative that has ever been produced by the human imagination that has faced more opposition, demonization, and demolition than the Gnostic message. It is the most opposed message in all of history. And of course, when people come to the Gnostic message, if they don't have something to compare it to, they think, if they listen to Graham Hancock, for instance, who is a friend and colleague of mine, talks quite a lot about Gnosticism lately. If you listen to him or any number of other people, you get this picture of the anti-cosmic perspective. They rejected the world. They renounced the world. Matter is evil. We're all caught in a dark matrix. That is not at all the true message of the Gnostics. So what I did in my book, and thankfully it seems to get across to a lot of people, is I brought out the message of the Gnostics on their own terms, not from the viewpoint of Judeo-Christian scholars who perpetuate the misinformation about them.
Indeed, yeah. And you mentioned Graham Hancock there, and you know, some of the listeners will have heard the term archon, because it's become almost a meme at this point in our modern age, and people may not realize that John is largely responsible for kind of uncovering that term and bringing it into the discourse. And you have the likes of David Icke and Jay Widener and people like that who've used this term quite a lot. And someone like David Icke, I mean, he is essentially a world renouncer in the sense that he says that this is all illusion. We are all one, and I don't know the finer details of his worldview, but people who listen to him might get the impression of this Gnosticism being this world renouncing thing. But if I could just ask, I'm really interested, Rob, in your kind of journey with this. You know, did you have a misunderstanding of Gnosticism yourself before coming across John's work, or you know, what was it like for you?
I would say almost identical to what you were talking about, where if I'd gone into this at any level at all, you always find this allusion to Demiurge, Yahweh, being the creator of the world, and therefore, you know, through negation of all the sort of primal urges that you have, you need to get yourself out of here. So yeah, it was confusing. But it wasn't really until really Not in His Image that I had any idea about what we were looking at and the scope and breadth of that as the underlying reality and story of our place in this universe, really.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. I bet it's quite a common journey that people have been
on. Of course, you can imagine, say, some relatively intelligent person who takes an interest in Gnosticism, and they look around on the internet, or they read maybe 5 or 6 books, maybe they read 10 books. And these books are all going to reinforce the disinformation profile on the Gnostics. So then when they see my book somewhere, or someone mentions it, or it pops up on the internet, they're going to think, well, you know, I've read 10 books about Gnosticism. I don't need to read another one, but this is precisely the one you need to read if you're interested in Gnosticism. And at least then, if you read my book, you have something to compare to the other version. Okay, sorry to be so emphatic, but you get my point.
Yeah, Rob, what were you saying, Rob?
I was very broadly agreeing with John there, and trying to get across how important it is to be able to get a different perspective from that. And I'm just wondering who was really responsible for this propaganda at the early instigation of Christianity?
Well, Hippolytus, Epiphanius, Irenaeus. You could probably make a list of, at the top of the list, there would be say 5 names of what were called the heresy hunters, because Gnosticism was considered to be, and is in fact, the greatest heresy of all time, but it is a heresy of truth. So they considered Gnostic doctrines and practices to be heretical. Who is they? The early Christian ideologues. So you could start with those writers like Irenaeus, who have left an account of the Gnostics, but the account is titled Against Heresies. So I've compared the work of Irenaeus, which is a source of information about the Gnostics, but I've compared it to the dossier of the prosecution. So how much truth are you going to find in the file of the prosecution if you're trying to look at the character and actions of the defendant? You know, until now, there hasn't been anyone to defend Gnostics on their own terms, not till I showed up, as far as I know.
And go on, John.
No, that's it.
I mean, it almost seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it almost seems like you can draw, in comparing Gnostics to the pagans, it's almost as if when we talk about the pagans, we are talking about the people who lived pre the emergence of Christianity as a religion. And when we're talking about the Gnostics, we're talking about pagans who almost had to rebrand themselves and were persecuted during the early era of Christianity. Do you think there's anything to what I'm saying there?
Well, Gnostics were pagans, yes, but they were intellectual pagans.
Right.
So they not only, let's say, met the qualifications, if you want to use that term, of what a genuine pagan today would consider to be necessary, you know, reverence for nature, the perception that all is alive, animism, the study of the stars, it's tremendously important. They were great astronomers. Study of the stars and the seasons, communication with the telluric forces of the earth, and everything that you can put into a basic checklist. And you would say, yeah, that, and that is pagan. It defines the attributes of paganism. They had, and they had intellect. They were intellectual pagans. So they were the great educators and teachers of the ancient world. The mystery schools were the spiritual universities of the ancient world. And so the mystery schools arose at a certain time and took the form, arose in very ancient times. I trace the roots of the Gnostic movement back to about 6,000 BC in northern Iran. People who founded what later became the Gnostic movement were Aryan Caucasians, Persians from northern Iran, right? And then when it developed and the movement developed and grew into a network, and at a certain moment, which is a really critical moment in antiquity, when literacy came to be popular, you know, if you read any study of ancient history, like ancient Greek history or the Middle East, you say, okay, this is an interesting development. Oh, at a certain point, alphabets, secular alphabets were introduced and people started reading and writing. The Gnostics were the teachers who introduced literacy. They educated the entire Mediterranean, the world around the Mediterranean basin. The great Egyptian teachers were Gnostics. So it's a generic term for a class of teachers who had a strong intellectual component in what they did, but they were rooted in the worldview of paganism. And they worshiped the earth under the name of a specific figure. So that's my profile of them. And unfortunately, you know, I think I did a talk on my YouTube channel where I said, how come I don't get invited on a platform to sit at one side of the table? And then all the other people today, like Graham and Greg Braden and David Icke, who are presenting their perspective of Gnosticism, can sit on the other side of the table and let the world know that there are two versions of it so that people can choose which one they like, which one appeals to them. But I don't get invited to those conversations.
That's because you're a heretic in the true sense of the word, John.
Yeah, and that's also because I talk about something that they never talk about. But we might not go to that in this particular conversation.
No, if it becomes relevant at some point, of course we can. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, Gnostic ideas were found among the Pythagoreans, the Platonists, Zoroastrians, Egyptians, the Hermeticists. It's really kind of an umbrella term, isn't it?
It can be, but it's also, I maintain that it is better if we define it quite specifically, because it can be used loosely. You know, there's the longstanding joke is that in, 1986, all of the prominent Gnostic scholars in the world met in Messina in Italy. It's called the Messina Conference. 1986, by the way, was about 10 years after the Nag Hammadi Library appeared in English. Okay. So they had a worldwide conference and they spent, 3 days or 3 weeks And they could not come up with a common definition of narcissism. You know, but I do have a very clear and specific definition of who the Gnostics were. And you define them by their belief system, by their narrative, and by what they taught. That's how I define them.
Well, yeah. Speaking of, would you be so kind as to give us as brief as possible, or as, you know, as concise as possible, an overview of the fallen goddess scenario? So the kind of central, you know, foundational myth of, or, you know, what do you call it? A poetic myth of Gnosticism.
Yeah, it is the guiding myth of the Gnostic movement. And one way to introduce it is to show how illustrate what I consider to be the fundamental refutation of the view that narcissism is world renouncing. It considers this world to be a trap, a matrix, and it considers matter to be evil, right? The creation of an evil demiurge, right? The best refutation of that is found in bits and pieces throughout the Nag Hammadi texts. But principally and ironically, the best refutation of that can be found in the works of Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus was a Christian ideologue who wrote a book, attributed to him anyway, probably a compilation, called Against Heresies. And as I said before, you can consider it to be the dossier of the prosecution. So he's compiling a case against the Gnostics to prove how perverted they were and how they were dangerous heretics. But in the process of condemning them, he has to, in a way, represent their view, right? He has to represent the view of his opponent in order to argue against it. Can you see that?
Yeah, right.
And you have to read Irenaeus and these other heresy haters like Epiphanius and Hippolytus very, very carefully, because in some respects, they represent the views they are opposing held by Gnostics accurately. But in other respects, they do not represent the views of the other side accurately. But to the extent that they do, you find in Irenaeus that he said that the Gnostics said that there was a supreme goddess from the galactic core, they call it the Pleroma, a galactic scale divine entity called Sophia. And they were most interested in her because they recognized in her, through many generations of investigation and study, that she is the indwelling spirit and indwelling presence of the earth. And it says in Irenaeus, and also in certain passages in Nag Hammadi and elsewhere, that she turned into the earth. So how can it possibly be that if Sophia is the central figure of the Gnostic movement, and they see her as a galactic scale goddess who morphed into the planet Earth, how can they possibly consider matter to be evil? And how can they consider the Earth to be a place where the divine spark is trapped in an evil matrix? You see, it's impossible. So the fallen goddess scenario is just that. It is the elaborate myth, which is a sacred story, not a fiction, about how the earth came to be, the origin of the human species, the origin of the archons, the way that the earth came into existence today. According to this narrative, the earth was not created by a god. It is the body of a goddess. And if that doesn't resonate with every heathen and pagan in the world, then I'll eat my socks.
Yeah.
How can it not? How can it not? You know, I said to Dan and the three of us when we were talking the other day, getting to know each other, I said, I consider it a great tragedy This book has been out for 15 years. And when it came out in 2006, I was thinking, because I've always had a real fond spot for pagans and heathens and, you know, Wicca and that sort of thing. Although I think some of the things they do can be quite silly. And I think there's a fair amount of fraud in the movement, such as Margot Adler and Starhawk, who were very, very big, you know. But I embrace the genuine grassroots spirit of paganism and the heathen way of life. Absolutely. I am of that root, same root. And I thought, wow, I can't wait. Just wait until the people in that movement hear about this. It's just going to be like a marriage made in heaven. You know, this is so great. They're just going to love this story because it brings everything into a cosmic perspective. And it puts the goddess Sophia, the divine earth mother figure, at the center of our cosmology. And so, yes, the Sophianic narrative is like the umbrella under which all the varieties in the spectrum of paganism can meet and recognize each other. And that's also, my friends, what it originally was, until all those indigenous movements were shattered. And when they were shattered and attacked due to Christianity and Islam, they lost coherence. And this narrative, the biography of the living earth, which explains our purpose in this world, brings back that coherence. It restores the whole pagan worldview to wholeness.
Yeah, indeed. And this is why I preface this conversation by saying that I think it's an extremely important one. And it's something I'm so glad and honored to be having, because for me, there has always been a connect between my heathen worldview and John's presentation of Gnosticism. And it does seem like an enormous travesty to me that these two schools of thought have not been brought together in such a way until now, really.
Well, yes. I said to both of you in that previous conversation, I was waiting for someone for 15 years. I think one woman in 15 years wrote me, found me on an internet interview, of which there are dozens and dozens, and said, well, I'm a practicing Wiccan, and, you know, I read your book, and I find that your view of the pagan character of the Gnostics is really credible, really solid, and very compatible with my practices. One person in 15 years. Right. I you know, where is Asatru? Where are the people who are in these movements in Europe and the United States who going back and trying to reclaim their ancestral roots and pick up the fragments of their indigenous wisdom of their ancestors? Why aren't they coming to me? Why aren't they attracted to this book? And I think we already answered that. It's because the disinformation gets in the way. They don't even know the book is here. They don't have a chance to see if there is a deep compatibility between this version of Gnosticism and their practices. And that is a tragedy.
John, I would agree with you altogether on that. I'd also draw attention toward the sort of commonality that myself and Dan have, which is within the alternative kind of, I guess, broadly speaking, metal community of musicians and all that kind of stuff. And funnily enough, you find a lot of people who are interested in the mysteries broadly, paganism, heathenism, this kind of stuff, deeply embroiled in that particular scene too. So there's almost like there's an audience there which not a lot of people have access to as well. So it's interesting as well to come back to what you were saying earlier on about this, the perception of the negation of nature and the anti-human interpretation that was given, broadly speaking, to Gnosticism by the authorities. And something has gone on, which Dan and I talked about as well, within the music scene. And it's been this push toward a sort of misanthropic worldview. It can be perceived as anti-human, anti-nature, and very negative as well. So I think both of us have a degree to say about that as musicians. And for my own part, you know, with your work itself has been highly influential in at least a couple of albums that I've put out, and I've tried to interpret what you say as best as I'm able to within a sort of 3-4 minute song, and try and put these ideas out and across to that audience. So I'm hoping that some people have picked up on that, and I've certainly had a lot of feedback, both for, you know, the work of John Lamlash, and also interest in people like Valet and John Keel, who we mutually talk about from time to time.
Yeah. Well, certainly appreciate that you've done that, because for artists, musicians and artists and creators to absorb the Gnostic intel, as I call it, and to learn and love the story of our living mother, the Aeonic Mother, we call her by all kinds of names, nicknames for her, but, you know, they call her the Aeon Sophia, the goddess Sophia. Her name means wisdom. That if that mystique of Gnosticism could seep into the scene, excuse me, of music and arts, it would be wonderful. Do you know Omnia?
The name rings a bell. Is that a band?
Yeah. It's a Dutch band that does.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. They were very big. I haven't heard about them. I haven't looked up them up in a while. But some years ago, I think it was like 8 or 9 years ago now, I got in touch with them on the internet. I sent them a copy of Not in His Image, because they're doing all of these. excuse me. Wouldn't you say there's a genre? I can't name the groups, but you might know them. They're Swedish or Norwegian groups. You see the video. You see them all dressed up. They're wearing antlers. They have drums.
You're speaking about Heilung and Wardruna.
Yeah. And there are quite a few groups like that, aren't there?
Yeah. And, it's become very popular.
Right. And Omnia was very, very big. And they were always dressing up they wore, you know, genuine pagan gear in their performances. And get songs about, you know, Earth Warrior was one of their really big hits. And so if people in that genre could pick this up, it would be tremendous.
Yeah. Well, just to go, what Rob was saying there about the metal scene being kind of full of this misanthropic negative vibe, I think maybe this is one of the reasons why, you know, a reasonable number of metal musicians are interested in, you know, John's presentation of Gnosticism, and in my opinion should be, because it's still heretical. You know, I mean, let's face it, as metal musicians and punk musicians, we are generally drawn to the heretical. You know, we have this kind of this rebellious streak which wants to go in the opposite direction of mainstream society. But what the fallen goddess scenario offers to people like us is both a heretical mythology that is also extremely positive.
It is. Yes. It's beautiful and inspiring. It's not a black pill way of life. Mm-hmm. On the contrary. And I find that in all the years now since I wrote my book, and since I've been teaching planetary tantra, which might be called the practical application of Gnosis today, because this is not a nostalgic trip. They're not going back, you know, to antiquity and relive Gnosis. It has to be lived anew today. Since I've been doing that, I can tell you that what brings people toward this message and keeps them there is it is so beautiful and inspiring. I mean, this story about Sophia and what happened to her, and how the human genome was created, and how the human genome is propagated through many worlds, and the particular conditions of the divine experiment we're in here on the earth now, and the role of the archons and where they came from, and how they work into our world as an intrusive and parasitical factor. I mean, it's brilliant, vastly complex and beautiful story. Yeah. And people just fall in love with it.
Yeah, and before, you
simple
know,
as that.
I can imagine that some of the pagans listening will be thinking, right, you know, I've been listening for a while now and I'm yet to hear any real evidence to suggest that this is similar. But let me remind particularly those who follow the Germanic Norse tradition that we have in the Prose Edda, Snorri Sturluson's Prose Edda, we have the cosmological myth of Audumbla, the cow, being the progenitor of this world. And as John mentioned in our private discussion, there is perhaps a case to be made that Audumbla and Sophia are one and the same.
There is indeed a case to be made, and I have expended enormous effort to try to show that in the Sophianic narrative, the fallen goddess scenario, I also call it the home story, which I had to restore. I had to recover and restore it because it had been so attacked and demonized that there were only fragments of it left. But through the Nag Hammadi and other Greek, Egyptian, Coptic, Syriac, Iranian texts, I was able to reconstruct it into a coherent narrative. And what I find is that in some ways, the plot and the factors in the Sophianic narrative in some ways can be seen to correlate with the gods and goddesses and the events in the Icelandic and the Nordic and Teutonic mythology in some ways. But I say that with a great, great caution. And so I want to say that I find, for instance, what you mentioned, Dan, is to me irrefutable. There's no doubt that the Nordic, indigenous Nordic peoples, they saw in the figure of the great cow mother and who gives her milk, who nourishes the earth, they saw their version of the Gnostic Sophia. And I can prove that, and I have proven that. But unfortunately, it's not possible to make those correlations consistently. And the reason, and it grieves me to say this, but I have to say it to be honest to any pagans who are listening, pagans, heathens, Nordic revivalists, the state of your spiritual legacy from your indigenous ancestors is in such pitiful ruins that it's very difficult to make anything coherent out of it. And that is a very great problem. But I think that if we recognize that problem, then we can say, well, we all recognize the same divine source, which is Mother Earth. She's the supreme divine source in Gnosticism. And so could that possibly be a strange attractor? Could that possibly be the point around which we meet, the campfire where we meet? And then we can see if these things fit together. But I have to tell you, it's not easy to fit them together very often. I've done the best that I can because I am a comparative mythologist after all.
No, you
it's
are
my job.
You are right. There is uncertainty in the pagan source material that we have left to us. I mean, if I could give one example, in we have Loki Laufeyson, who is the brother of Odin. And even today among heathens, we have a difference of opinion as to whether Loki is a negative or a positive force or whether he is both. Whereas in Gnostic lore, as I understand it, there is no question mark over the archons and their purpose or their modus operandi. So I think what we have in the Norse lore is we have many of the names and we have many of the stories, but we have little kind of opinion or hard kind of affirmative decisions as to what things did represent. So a lot of it is left down to our interpretation. Whereas, as I understand it with Gnostic lore, if you know how to read the Gnostic scriptures, you start to find, and I think John found, that, you know, it's all actually quite certain.
Yes, it's clear and it's exact and comprehensive. So I found the plot of the Iranian narrative comes from Persians. Persians are white Caucasian people. Do you know, by the way, have you ever heard this? I just want to throw this in because this is quite delightful. Most people, many people may have heard of Ossetia. You know where Ossetia is?
Ossetia.
It's in the Caucasus Mountains. You don't hear much about it. There's North and South Ossetia.
Right.
So they're in the heart of the Caucasus Mountains. And it's my view that the homeland of the Gnostic movement was in the Caucasus Mountains, north of Iran, okay? So Ossetia, you hear about it sometimes like in Russian politics. It's like Chechnya, you know. It's a little tribal kind of area in that part of Russia. Well, it so happens that it has been shown both by philological research and also by historical research in antiquity that the Ossetians, who were in ancient times called the Alani people, and they're related to the Scythians, are of the same race as the Irish today. And there are pictures of Irish men and women living today in Ireland, and which are identical to the people living in Ossetia. And so I make the point, when I locate the origin of the Gnostic creation myth in that area, that it was the matrix of all of the white indigenous Indo-European people, additional to the northern matrix.
Right. Fascinating. And actually that...
So there was a northern matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No. Finish, John, please.
Well, big story and big things we're talking about. And there's a lot to cover in this introductory talk. But again, if I might, you know, make a peace offering to you. See, one of my disadvantages, this is serious, I can't converse with you about how pagan heathen views and practices are compatible with Gnosis, because I don't know what they are, because I don't know what they're doing. What is a heathen creation myth? I don't think there is one. I don't find one, and I'm a comparative mythologist, and I've read them all. Where is a coherent, comprehensive, clear, and actionable heathen creation myth? Where is it?
You mean aside from the story of Althumbla and the Geninga Gap and the meeting of fire and ice to create matter as we know it, and the
that's the creation
gap.
Story.
Yes, I mean there's more to it than that, but unless I'm misunderstanding what you're
saying, I have not had the opportunity, which I would love to have.
Yeah,
to sit down to meet someone who says, okay, I'm dedicated to heathen views. I go back to the indigenous roots.
This is as far as we know, this is the creation story as given to us in the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda. We have the Geninga Gap, from which matter emerged by the meeting of fire and ice. And then we have the primeval cow Althumbla, from whose teats the gods and the giants were fed. And then we have Ymir, who was slain by Odin, Bili, and Ve, and from him the earth was created. You know, so we have a slight difference there, perhaps with Gnostic lore. And then,
who created the earth? How did the earth come to be? Who are the gods? How do you distinguish the divine gods at the level of the galactic level? Is there a definition of the gods at the galactic level, compared to what happens in a solar system, compared to what happens on the Earth? Are those distinctions clear?
Other than knowing throughout the mythology that the gods and the giants, or the Jotun, as they should rightly be called, because giant is a bit of a misleading term, we know that they have generally been at odds the entire time. We know that the Jotun all descend from Ymir, whereas the gods and goddesses descend directly from, I believe, Buri, who descends from Althimbla. So but essentially there are two lineages, both of which go back to Althimbla. And that is the kind of most obvious defining factor between the gods and the giants. And the gods have their home in Jotunheim, and they are...
Where is Jotunheim?
I mean, that's a topic in its own, because we have the nine worlds of heathen lore. Most people believe that they are symbolic, or perhaps they are different spiritual realms as opposed to physical places that we can name within the cosmos.
Well, as I said, I'm at a disadvantage, and I must admit that I probably can't converse with you adequately or in a proper way, because I don't really see, from my viewpoint, how any of that is a coherent cosmology. It sounds to me like a chaotic fairy tale, which has symbolic meanings attached to it. And please, if I'm wrong, correct me. But I can tell you for sure that when you look into the Gnostic myth of the Aeon Sophia, it don't look anything like that. Nothing. It's very specific. It describes something that happened in the core of this galaxy at a certain moment, and it describes the ensuing events that led to one of the divinities of the core, which the Gnostics call an Aeon, emerging from the core of the galaxy and eventually morphing into the planet Earth. It's a totally different kind of story, but it's a story that is real. It's an astronomical myth. Mm. Maybe it would help if I said this one thing, and I would say anyone listening to me who hasn't heard about this for the first time might find that I'm not being terribly helpful or coherent. But let me tell you this. You can take this away. The Fallen Goddess scenario is a myth that describes an astronomical event, which is the expulsion of a plasmic jet from the galactic core. That's what it actually describes. But it puts it all in animistic language. So that plasmic eruption from the core of the galaxy is the goddess Sophia. We don't place her in some mythical symbolical realm. And it's all material. It's all astronomical.
So it bridges the mythical with the scientific. So
absolutely. It is a solid astronomical model, solid astronomical narrative. And I can't tell you, you'd have to talk maybe to someone who's been on board with me for some years, the amount of work I've done in sidereal mythology, teaching people how to read the sky, how to read the living myth of our planet and species in the sky, in real time, now. This is what you can do on the foundation of Gnosticism. It's not some made-up fairy tale that you just interpreted in one way or another. It's extremely precise. And in that precision, it is very powerful. And it has the ability to direct the lives of people. It gives force and direction to people's lives precisely because it is so well plotted and so coherent. And unfortunately, you don't find that in these surviving indigenous mythologies, you see, in my opinion.
One thing that you do hear from people who are familiar with John's work is that the fallen goddess scenario that he has described briefly in this discussion, they describe that as an immensely beautiful story. And it's actually something that's more easily remembered than the cosmological origins of the gods and Jotun of heathen lore. I must admit, as a heathen myself, it's a beautifully simple story. And I think that's one of the reasons that it does resonate so strongly with so many people.
Absolutely. And everyone who gets this message, who realizes that there is something called a Sophianic message and the Sophianic way of life in the world. Everyone who gets it says the same thing. This story is so beautiful. It's so coherent. It has a force of its own. It's like the story, the myth is like a living thing on its own terms. And it allows you to look at nature. It allows you to look at the sky. I teach a lot about the sky and the constellations, and to be participating in the wonder of all that in a very intense way, but also in a very clear way. You know, these other mythologies, the Nordic, the Eddic, the Icelandic, the Teutonic, they're jumbled. It's a jumble of things. And I'm not dissing it, you know, but I'm saying it's a jumble compared to what you find in the Sophianic narrative.
I would also add, if I may.
Yeah, please. Please
I'd also
do,
add that it's something which is so essential at this particular time that we're living through right now, because we are in a serious state. Things are going on right now around us, and most of us have been aware of this. Most of us are even momentarily awake to this, know that something is going on right now, and we need to be able to maintain a focus, and we need to be able to establish an intimate contact with everything that is real, as opposed to everything which is unreal, because we are in a confrontation between illusion, deception, and the other side of that, which is our natural inclination and our love and respect and the abundant sort of joy that you can have through your intimate contact with nature itself. And I'm like really emphatic about this, because it's the feeling that I get from this, which I don't think there's any problems to be encountered between native shamanic pagan mythology in any particular place and John's establishment of the Gnostic narrative at all. I don't see that. I just see fragmentary pieces here and there, which need to be able to, as John quite rightly points out here, we need to be able to sit around a campfire and say, okay, let's talk this one out, because all at that fundamental level have the greatest respect and joy in nature itself. And it's, you know, right now, all of that is completely on the line. You know, we're in a critical time now.
And what I would, I very much agree, Rob. That's really well put, actually. And I think especially with what's going on now across the world, the Gnostic myth, you know, the eternal truth, as some people call myth, what that offers us is actually a very clear answer as to who, what, and why is going on, in a way which the pagan mythologies don't offer in such a clear way. And you know, I'm sure we'll get onto that in a minute, as to the subject of the archons and what role this illusory force is playing, particularly in you know, over the last couple of years. It really seems to have stepped up a notch, as I think we all feel.
Indeed. I would say that I agree with Rob. We're in there's a battle between real and fake. It's not just illusion, it's fake, it's fraud. Why is everything in our world, in the social world, fraudulent? Everything is fraudulent. The banking system, education, media, IT is a big fraud, you know. The hyping of IT and robotics, transhumanism. If you want to know what the problem of transhumanism really is about and where it comes from, and how the Gnostics caught it before anyone else did, and how what they said about it is valid today, then you find it in this book. And to my knowledge, you will not find it anywhere else.
It went, you know, many people have said over the last couple of years, you know, we've all, those of us who are awake to what's going on, we look at our friends and our family and those around us in the streets, the strangers that walk past us on the pavement. And many of us describe them as being almost in a trance, almost in a zombie-like state. And we've questioned, why is it that they seem to be viewing these current events in a completely different manner to the way that I'm seeing them? And I think, again, we have the answer in John's presentation of Gnosticism, because when some people talk about Gnosticism being world renouncing, claiming that, you know, this entire material cosmos is itself an illusion, actually what you find when you read John's book, Not in His Image, is that what John's actually saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, John, is that this material world itself is not the illusion. The illusion is placed upon it within our minds. And we're seeing perfect examples of that today with people who seem to be viewing this global crisis, so to speak, in entirely different ways. Some of them are seeing it through the veil of illusion, whereas some of us are seeing it for what it really is.
Yes, indeed. The Gnostics did not condemn the world as evil. They did not consider matter to be evil. They did not consider this world to be an illusion. Often the word Hindu word Maya is cited. Maya does not mean illusion, by the way. I won't get into that, but I will mention that I incorporate a tremendous amount of Eastern mysticism and Hindu Tantra and Tibetan Tantra into correlation with the practice of Gnosis today. I make a beautiful blend of those things. And the point of it all, the point of all of the work, is to see the nature of evil, because we're in an endgame with evil, and it is coming to the last battle. And this, how is this evil originate? How did it develop? Well, the Gnostics were tracking this evil. They were the first ones who detected it and exposed it. That's why they had to be destroyed, because if they could have exposed the evil of the transhumanist race supremacy ideology at the beginning of the Christian era, if they could have exposed it, then we wouldn't be anywhere where we are today. We would never have got into this mess, you see.
Yeah.
The big subject. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go on, Dan.
No, you go, Rob.
Right. Yeah, John, something that you have pointed out in your work is that it's almost as if the malevolent, directly evil part of this equation is really something which is carried out in the human sphere rather than the archontic sphere, because that in itself tends to be from mischievous through to extremely deceptive, and it doesn't encapsulate the idea of evil as we perceive it, but rather that seems to be something which is interpreted through the human interaction of that mind parasite.
Yes, that's correct. One of the great benefits of the Gnostic intel, as I call it, is that it explains the origin and operations of evil. And big subject, of course, but I can make two quick points, which I think clear the way. One of the points is that Gnosticism is not a variety or variant of Zoroastrianism, even though they both were of Persian origins. It does not posit a cosmic principle of good and a cosmic principle of evil. According to the Gnostics, there is no cosmic evil. There is a paranormal, malevolent influence called the Archons, which is more of the nature of a parasite. And that is the mind parasite. And so evil, in terms, in the view of a living Gnostic today, evil is something that we commit. Evil is a product of human actions. However, you'll have to add the most imperative qualification, that what turns human actions to evil, and we see that everywhere today, particularly in transhumanism, is a paranormal extra-human influence. But it's only an influence. It's not a cosmic force of evil acting on the world. And this is the nature of the Archons. And it is true, as far as I know, that I was the person who introduced the word archon to the internet. Not that it didn't exist on the internet in some form before 2002, but I was the one who introduced it in context.
Yes.
In the Gnostic context. Right.
David Icke owes you an apology for that, doesn't he?
Well, David Icke spent one of his Wembley talks of 7 hours. He spent, I think, 35 minutes talking about Nakamati and the Archons and the Gnostics. And he kept saying, and the Gnostics said this and the Gnostics said that. Well, David, I know you've read my book because someone was at your house and they saw it and you tapped it and you said, this is a very important book. So the next time you do a 7-hour talk, you might say, John Lash says that the Gnostics said that. Okay.
Yeah.
Just to be a little more accurate, but I don't bear any grudges against him at all. But again, David Icke is not capable of facing the problem of evil. He thinks it's just a frequency change. All we have to do is raise to a higher frequency and the reptilians will disappear and we'll all be living in bliss. You know, Gnosticism.
Extraordinary.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, John, come on. I'm just saying this extraordinary level of ignorance out there at the moment about the nature of the problem itself. You know, it's just, mind-boggling. And disinformation within, it's sort of like passing off good information with bad at the same time is as bad as just passing off something awful in the first place. So it's useless. It's
indeed
contaminated.
It is. Well, I can tell you that the people that I know who are close to me, small group, and the wider people in my school, Nemeta, and beyond that, the wider branch around the world, who have discovered the beauty and power of the Gnostic message through my work, they know exactly what's going on. They are not in the least confused about where the evil is coming from, how it works, how the archons work, and they know what the archonic infection is. And when you know that, you cannot any longer be confused by the world drama, which is taking us toward the end game. We're at the end game now with the enemies of life and the psychopaths. And in my view, Gnosis is a great medicine. And also it's the force that can inspire the warrior in this battle that we're facing.
So, you know, I've got some notes to follow here for this conversation, and I think it would be prudent to kind of jumble them about a bit, because we're going down this direction where I think we could probably talk about how Gnostic lore can help paganism to make sense of this new kind of relatively new to most people, transhumanist era, this digital control system that's emerging and has been, you know, heavily propelled by the COVID narrative, with this idea of a cashless society, of new forms of digital passport, of things like that. How can, because, you know, around the time that this discussion will be published, I'm performing some music at an event in London called Pagan Futures, which actually will be attempting to deal with pretty much the same question. But I would really love to hear John and Rob's take on this. You know, what can we take from Gnostic lore at this specific time to face this emerging technocratic control grid that's emerging?
Rob, you want to put in a word?
I'll have a stab at it, if I may.
Please.
Yeah, but I would say through my own experiences in the last few years, where I've kind of like come brutally face to face with the wall that you do when you want to talk about things that you're not supposed to talk about. In those particular times where everything else was spinning out of control, and I felt I was personally going a little bit crazy, which I've always been, but what was always a grounding force was to be able to go out into the garden or down to the shore or touch the sea or just make contact with nature, because we really need an earthing point at this time. a very literal earthing point, because everything else seems to come from that. It's like if you earth yourself and you feel strength in that, you can see all this stuff coming down the line as it comes down, and you can just push it to one side, or deal with it as you have to deal with it. But we are entering a time, in my opinion, which is very, very critical. And I think we probably all share that, an anxiety, which we don't really need to be anxious about, because it doesn't really matter whether we live or die and all the rest of it. It's just to have the best life that you can, not in the selfish way, but to be able to manifest the things that are within you and which you feel within your life and your world are most important. To me, that's like, yeah, that's the thing. So let's be strong. Let's be brave. Let's get together with people that feel a sense of kinship with us. And it doesn't matter from which varying traditions they are and all the rest of it. If we can establish the fact that we all have at our center the one pulsing heart, which is that, yeah, that we belong here and we don't want something else to try and displace us.
Well, certainly, I like what you say, because obviously, if we're not grounded and we don't recognize our divine source, it's right in front of us. It's not invisible. It's not remote. You know, if we don't recognize it as the living earth mother and bond with her and bond in communities and get out of the cities. If you want to have a life worth living, you can't live in a city. It's impossible, because those are the places where they are closing down this, bringing this system into its culmination. All of that for sure, but as well to be able to recognize really clearly, I mean, just lucidly, to know where this evil comes from. Where does COVID come from? Whoever invented this and why? And what kind of a psyop is it? It's a psyop, and it's not the first. There are many, many psyops. 9/11 was a psyop. You know, some of us who study this know this now. And of course, when you study these things, it's not easy, it can be painful. But eventually, if you're sober, you sit back on your heels and you think, well, wait a minute, where is all this coming from? There's a saying that I like to quote from the Nag Hammadi text, which says, whoever does not know the source of evil is no stranger to it. And that is a very big warning. It means that anyone in the world today, no matter what your conditions of life are, rich or poor, living in the country, living in the city, if you don't know, if you can't see and identify what the actual source of this evil is, then you are no stranger to it, and you may even be accessory to it. And many people are. They are accessory to it either out of stupidity or out of fear, or they may belong to the executive branches of evil. And that's a really interesting subject, you see. And Gnostic teachings take you right to it. You know, transhumanism is not something recent. Transhumanism has been around for about 4,000 years. And one of the things that I do in the first six chapters of my book is I expose the historical root of what is today called transhumanism, which is nothing other than a program to either enslave or replace or eradicate the human species. It's been around for a long time. It's just now in its culmination. And all of this that is happening today, politics, the lies, the fraud, phony wars, COVID, monkeypox, all of this can be seen really clearly by the benefit of the Gnostic intel and the Gnostic perspective.
Yeah.
So I don't know if any pagan, you know, what does a pagan or heathen practitioner, how do they explain evil? How do they explain the COVID psyop? You know, can they explain it?
I think most of them, you know, just to take a stab at it, because, you know, I can't speak for the whole heathen movement, but I would
right,
say,
of course not.
I would say that most would look at it as essentially just tribalism. That's all that we're, all that's going on, all that we're seeing with this this global endgame takeover is one tribe or one set of coalition of tribes, perhaps, trying to take as much power for themselves as possible, and that their only real their only real motive in doing this is material gain.
Right. Okay. Hold that thought for just 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
This is brilliant. And I would respond in this way. Obviously, you know, obviously it's tribalism. And obviously we know which tribe it is because they've been exposed and they blow their own horns so loud. How can you not know who they are and what their goals are? But seeing it as just tribalism is not enough. What is it in that particular ethnic group that drives them to behave in that way? And what the Gnostics taught and what I teach today, and I hold by this, this is a hard line of what I teach. You cannot either comprehend or overcome the workings of evil in the world today unless you consider the paranormal factor. The way right. that tribe behaves is inhumane and insane.
Right.
But why are they inhumane and insane? How did they get to be that way? How did they get to have the moral disposition to want to rule over everyone else?
Where does that
Where does that come from?
Where does that psychopathy come from?
Exactly. And when you know that, you have knowledge, which is power. And from that standpoint, we can see how to expose them and oppose them.
Well, yes.
And that gets into very interesting territory.
Yeah.
And, I'm not going to take us there because this is...
John, this is
the first date, man. Not. I won't go that far on the first date.
First base only, John.
Just the titties.
But that's what I want to warn you. That's where it goes. You better believe that's where it goes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. John's done some talks elsewhere before, namely with Red Ice, where he does go there, really. And I would implore everyone to check them out because they're very insightful. And I do agree. I mean, I think that, I am a heathen because it's my ancestral tradition. But I will readily admit that I don't think that heathen lore has as many answers to what we're facing as Gnostic lore does, as presented by John. And I think that's why it's so powerful, because this is more than a material struggle. There are opponents in this that they are not driven purely by material needs.
They're exobiological parasites. The Gnostic intel, both then and today in my update and extrapolation of it, it tells you exactly what they are in great detail. I've written masses about this. And I'm very happy for you to say that. It's better that you said that than I did, that what you find in my book contains something that perhaps the heathen and pagan advocates can't find. But I want to add this qualification. I don't have the opportunity. As I said at the beginning, it's tragic. Where's the conversation? I haven't had the opportunity to meet you and talk to you, my heathen and pagan brothers and sisters. And I regret if I'm misrepresenting your views in any way or appear to be dissing or discounting you. I have no intention, but we need to get to know each other a little better.
Yeah, John,
if we can.
John, just to make it clear to anyone who may, this may be their first, introduction to John, their first exposure. Just to make it clear, John has nothing but love and regards for the European folk and the European traditions.
I adore them and I carry them in my heart every day. We with my friends, like right now here, fortunately, I usually live in relative isolation and retreat, but now there's some people visiting who are practitioners of planetary tantra and I call it the living gnosis today. And we pour our hearts out about this. We were talking about it last night for hours. How are the indigenous peoples all over Europe you know, the Basques, the Danes, the Swedes, I'm here in Galicia. Do you know that the Spanish people in Galicia, northern Spain, don't consider themselves to be Spanish? They consider themselves to be Celtic.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and yet when you walk around the fields here, when, there are some dolmens here and there. I am sure that this farmland in northern Spain must have been a dolmen paradise. But when you walk around the fields here, as I do very often, I can sort of see, oh, there might have been a dolmen there. There might have been a man here, there. But they've all been demolished. It's like this is the greatest tragedy that's overcome the human race. How are we going to recover these roots, you say?
And yeah, if you know, if I could just change gears slightly there, because what you said there and what Rob said a little earlier about the solution to what we're going through now, actually, I think you could make a very, very strong case that they also argue for Gnosticism being a life-affirming, world-affirming worldview. Because if we know that our enemies are destroying such things as the dolmens, we know that they've done that through thousands of years. If they were, you know, part of this force responsible for creating this material world, then why would they be doing that? Why would they be destroying nature?
Exactly.
And, you know, Rob, as Rob said, we all instinctively know, there's no doubt in our minds, people like us, that in order to escape the madness that we're currently, this archontic madness that we're suffering under at the moment, in order to escape that, we need to return to the earth. We ground ourselves and we immediately feel better. If the earth itself were part of this evil, negative illusion, then how could that possibly be the case?
Exactly. The more that you have the opportunity, and I am sad. I'm not mad, but I have been really angry with people like Jay Widener and Graham. Now, not personal. Angry on a professional level because they're disingenuous. Okay? But it would be so great if people could get to hear this other version of Gnosticism, because it would just click in. It makes so much sense. I was just reviewing a book last night by Yamauchi, who's a Gnostic scholar who looked deeply into the roots of the Sophia myth and Iranian mythology. And as I was reading it, it occurred to me that you can summarize the whole problem of the way Gnosticism and the Gnostic myth have been presented to the world in one simple example. And it like hit me. Like it was a Satori moment. I thought, yeah, this is what I have to tell people. Scholars of Judaism and Christianity take the disinformation and they build their Gnostic profile on the disinformation that comes out of antiquity. And the central factor in the narrative is the Demiurge. And they say the Demiurge is the satanic figure, Yahweh, Jehovah, who created the world. And the Gnostics viewed that as an evil event. But when you go, this is so hilarious. They're not reading the text. They're not seeing the forest for the trees. The Sophianic narrative says the Demiurge, which they called Yaldabaoth, okay, didn't create the world. He falsely claimed to create it. He pretends that he is the creator. It's about pretending. And I would say, look at the world today. How come this madness is so prominent? Because it's all about pretending. Boris Johnson said, pretend that you have the fucking virus. How could they be any more obvious? Right? Act as if you have it. That's the Archon speaking.
Could there be a more archontic instruction than that?
I can't think of one, honestly. Act as if you are sick, because we, the super race, the Elohim, the Adamic race, the tribe that lives above you, we are your benevolent caretakers, and you must be sick in order for us to fulfill our role to correct the world. You see?
Yeah.
Can heathens understand what we're talking about here on the basis of their indigenous legend and lore?
I think the folkish aspect of heathens will be very much in alignment with what we're saying now. I think.
Do you? Well, that's good news. I'm really happy to hear that.
I say that the folkish aspect, because I mean, if you were to remove the metaphysical aspect of heathenry, I think their more socio-political side would very much gel with what we're saying here. I think there is work to be done, perhaps on the metaphysical side of heathenry, and it's something that I and many of us are working on. We will uncover more and more truths, hopefully in collaboration with those who focus more on Gnosticism, such as yourself, John. You know, as you both said, you know, we do need to sit around the fire together, and
we do. And we just need to get together and talk. Yeah. On that note, go ahead, Rob.
Sorry, I'll tell you what kind of knits it together as well for me is, like, John was sort of very emphatic about the idea or the reality that when sort of Gnostic knowledge was alive and well throughout Europe and the Mediterranean, people could understand one another within these mystery schools without necessarily have share the same language, but they could understand themselves, one another, through symbols and through their relationship to the stars and the natural world and all this kind of stuff. And that's what it's about. It's about saying, it's almost like the comparative mythology angle, saying this can represent that, or we have a common language. We just need to say, let's find out what that is, and kind of re-piece the fragments that we've got of our deeply broken mythology here in the West. Find out what we were about. You know, what how does this relate? And one of the things that I found initially difficult about the Gnostic stuff before I came across John's work was really this idea about, here we go. Here's another, pardon me, but here's another sort of like Mediterranean, Near East, Middle East kind of thing, which doesn't really bear any relationship on us. And it's not until he's saying, well, you know, the Druids could talk with somebody from ancient Alexandria and they would understand one another. You know, they had the same kind of things going on. So that's all we need to do, is rediscover the language and the syntax, and we've got the conversation. It's good. It's healthy.
It's excellent what you say, Rob, and I can double down on it by saying it's not something that we have to do. It's being done. It's an accomplishment today. It is happening already on the basis of the restoration of the Gnostic myth of the Sophia and the updating, bringing forward the Gnostic intel so we can apply it in the world today. All of this is happening. And within that movement, the whatever remains to be salvaged from these obliterated ancestral legacies can be brought to the table. But I don't find that the body of those ancient legacies, as it stands on its own, is coherent enough and powerful enough to answer the problem of today. You are absolutely right. I point out in my book, and I give footnotes and extensive evidence in ancient sources, that the Druids in Hibernia taught the Hibernian mysteries, but they went to Egypt and conversed with the Egyptian astronomers, and the common language was the stars, the language of the stars. And that is, as you know, Rob, one of the primary things that I teach. You say, I teach sidereal mythology. I teach how to read the mythological code in the constellations, and not just interpret it, but to use it to direct your life. That's why I call it directive mythology.
Is this the same sort of principle as the language of the birds, which was known amongst alchemists?
I don't know. Mm. To me, that's an obscure trope. It may have been. I don't know. What does the language of the birds refer to? Does it refer to a mystical experience of hearing certain
It's
suboral frequencies that are like chirping sounds.
I think it's more of a symbolic thing to say that when you are a master alchemist, then you can understand the birds. It's I don't know if there was literally some kind of means of communication between alchemists from different cultures and traditions, or whether it was just a way of saying that if you were a master alchemist, then you understood nature and therefore you understood the language of the birds.
Well, yes, but you don't have to be an alchemist to talk to the birds or the dogs, do you? You don't have to be.
No,
people,
true.
Sensitive people who are grounded and recognize the enormous importance of our communication with non-human species, they can already do that. You don't have to construct it into a program of alchemy, even though I must add, that is exactly what I've done. I probably spent a third of my whole life writing about alchemy. There's a course on Nemeth called Gaian Alchemy, and it goes into the alchemical processes of nature and the human psyche with the criteria of gnosis. Gnosis presents criteria. You know, what is Gnosticism? What is Gnosis? Gnosticism is an ancient movement. We're not going there. This is not a nostalgia trip. What is the living Gnosis today? I define it in two ways. First of all, it's applied noetics, period. So if you would go and investigate on a search engine, what is noetics? What is noetic psychology? You'll find that it is the psychology of consciousness, of cognition and perception. It is the study of how consciousness and perception works. That's noetics. Gnosis today is applied noetics. That's one definition. The other definition is that it is cognitive ecstasy, which means that today there is an element within the practice of Gnosis that involves the use of entheogenic plants, as was done in the ancient mysteries. And I make a big case about this in my book. I show that the Gnostic schools in the various regions of Europe and the Mediterranean used various kinds of entheogenic plants. Why? Well, I put it this way, my friends. Our Divine Mother, Sophia, knew that we have a problem with the Archons, that there is an exobiological extraterrestrial parasite who preys on our minds. She knew that. And she knew that there was a risk that they would drive us insane. And so she produced out of her body a certain category of plants which are heavily nitrogen bearing. And these plants have psychomimetic and psychoactive properties. And they are there to help us heal the insanity that we face due to the attack of these mind parasites. And the Gnostics knew this deeply. And that is why they used entheogenic potions to go into a state which I call a telestic trance. And in this trance, they were actually in a state of ecstasy. And there are certain things that it can only be known in ecstasy. You cannot know them in an ordinary state of mind. You have to know them in a non-ordinary state. And so I've built that. That is a huge component of the Gnosis today. Am I getting across the picture of how rich this is and how diverse it is? But it's all grounded on the narrative. You have to know the narrative because that brings everything together and guides your experience of spirituality.
Yeah, and I think what you've just outlined there is a great example of counter-mimicry, because in our modern times, we see these naturally occurring entheogens. We see mankind being dissuaded from them, whilst at the same time, these man-made drugs are pushed upon them. These poor copies. You could almost call them archontic copies.
Yeah, I call them pharmaceutical products,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The pharmaceutical products are archontic tools.
Yeah.
Look at the misery and the sickness and insanity that they're produced in this world under the guise of healing and helping us. I want to highlight that the hype, the self-hype of the iconic proxies in our midst, the tribalists who carry the iconic evil into our midst, because it is a human evil, they always hype themselves as benefactors. Yeah, we've got all this medical technology. We're going to save lives. How many times have you heard save lives? I don't want to ever hear that those two words again in the same sentence because it's a con. It's a psyop.
What gave it away to me?
Yeah?
Yeah. What gave it away to me during this whole COVID psyop is this whole thing about how concerned they were for the median age, 82 or 83-year-olds with several different comorbidities. It's like, we've really got to save these people. It's like, you didn't give a toss about these people before. There's no reason why you should ever care about them anyway, because they're a burden, you know. So they tried to convince us, first of all, you should be saving granny. It's, well, granny financially and in every other respect there is a burden on their worldview as it is. So you could tell that the hoax was on from that minute, really.
Yeah, you could say in a way that the COVID psyop, I call it COVID, combining COVID with Soviet, because it is. Okay, yeah. It is communism, folks.
Yeah.
Communism is the greatest evil in the world. Communism is the product of the iconic mindset. Okay, this is what you learn.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could say that the whole COVID psyop was a gift in that it blew open. It makes it so obvious the fraud and the hypocrisy of the authorities. You see? Gnosis is anti-archon, meaning anti-authorities, because the translation of the word archon is authorities or rulers. So it is anarchistic. But I would point out, and I am an anarchist, but I would point out that anarchy means without rulers. It does not mean without rules.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mark Passio, I don't know if you're familiar with Mark Passio, but he does some excellent presentations on exactly that, talking about natural law and the importance of natural law, whilst at the same time heavily promoting anarchism.
Right. So these are all, you know, we're the three witches of Macbeth here, you know, sitting around the steaming cauldron, throwing in an eye of newt and a leg of frog, and throwing in all these things. It's all one big cauldron. That is the cauldron of Cerdwyn. That is the sacred cauldron of Scandinavian myth. What is it called?
There's the well, Mimir's Brunner.
It's Mimir's Brunner.
Mimir's well, yeah.
But it's also, there's a name for the cauldron in Hamlet's Mill. What is the name for that? The cauldron of the Scandinavian witch. The cauldron is the biosphere of the earth, and the human psyche is part of that biosphere. I teach in Gaian Alchemy that there is no difference between the phenomena of nature outside, dew, rain, frost, grass growing, things rotting. There's no difference between those phenomena and the phenomena in the human psyche. The human psyche is an act of nature as much as an apple growing on a tree.
That's a profound thing to say, especially when you tie that into alchemy, because alchemy is something where people believe that you're trying to turn something into gold. That's, most people assume that that's all that alchemy is, whereas real alchemy is the transformation of the mind and the spirit.
It's real alchemy is the practice, the conscious and deliberate practice of the interactivity of nature and psyche. That's what it is. And if I might, I don't like to promote myself, but at this point, it seems inevitable.
No, please do, John. Please do.
Anyone can go to nemeta.org, N-E-M-E-T-A. By the way, nemeta is the plural of the word nematon. And nematon means a sacred grove. And originally, all the indigenous peoples who are our beloved ancestors, whether they be in Scandinavia, Greece, Italy, Spain, or in the Middle East, practice in groves with megalithic structures. Gradually, that evolved into kind of temple structures, you see? So we go back to the sacred groves. When you go to Nemeta, you go back to the sacred groves of your ancestors. And everything on Nemeta if you just come on it as a pedestrian off the street, there are landing pages for 12 different courses, one of which is Gaian Alchemy. And anyone can read everything that's on that landing page and often listen to a recorded message so that you can learn what's happening in the school even before you consider maybe going a little bit deeper and getting involved in the school. So I want to point that out. You know, I've been teaching alchemy since I can't even remember when. When I was 10 years old, I discovered alchemy, and I've been obsessed with it ever since. But the alchemy that you find on Nemeta is not like you read in A.E. Waite or Aleister Crowley or any of these other freak occultists. You know, I'm an occultist, but I'm not that kind of occultist, because my occultism is based in the recognition that the natural world is an expression of the supernatural. There's no difference between the natural and the supernatural. The natural world, as you see it, is an expression or eruption of the supernatural. And the more deeply you participate in the natural world, the more you come to know the supernatural, which is also operating in your own psyche. And this is the education, the higher education that you can find at Nemeta.
Right. There's one more subject which I wanted to touch upon tonight. And I think this is quite prudent to do because of the kind of people that will be listening to this. I can tell now there are going to be accusations or cries of, universalism or syncretism, folkish heathens and folkish pagans are instinctively knee-jerk reactionary, in opposition to this idea of merging different traditions. Sometimes some people are a little more open-minded and will draw upon Vedic lore and bring that a little bit into European paganism. Some people are a bit more hardline about it. So John is not a universalist, as most people listening would understand the word. So with what we've talked about this evening, how can we avoid the charge of being accused of promoting universalism?
Brilliant. Well, I'll see if I can take a sober moment to address that. Probably would have to concisely make 3 points. First point I would make is that I developed in Not in His Image, in the opening six chapters, a very careful description of what the mysteries were. And I explained that the mysteries were a network all over Europe, Northern and Southern Europe, around the Mediterranean basin and into the Middle East. And I emphasized that the people in the Middle East, who were actually the originators of the mysteries, the Gnostics, were Aryans, okay? They were not whatever else or whoever else is living in the Middle East today. No. They were from the root stock of the Aryan Caucasian peoples. And so they were cousins to the Teutons and the Scandinavian peoples and the Iberic peoples and the Greeks. We're all one big family. And I emphasize that in every area, say out in the Outer Hebrides, where you go to Callanish, or you go to a stone circle in France of the many, Karnak, or you go to megalithic sites on Malta, or you go wherever you want to go, the mysteries were adapted bioregionally. So they met the needs of the people in the region where they arose, but they were organized in a generic way so that there was a common foundation, but each area, each people, each race had its own particular expressions.
Yes.
Now, I would answer to that objection. I take that objection really seriously. And I pull no punches. If you go listen to some of my talks on my channel, John Lamb Lash, why I am against universalism, I hate universalism. And I have exposed it, I believe, more than anyone else, more deeply than anyone else. But there is a, it seems to be universalism that I'm talking about. I can see how people would read it that way. And you're very right to bring this up, Dan. But it isn't. It's just the recognition that there is a generic grounding of our species. We are generically grounded in the species, and we unfold in a spectrum of races and indigenous cultures. So Gnosis takes you back to the generic genomic foundation of human identity. And in that sense, it is universalist, but it does not preach a universalist agenda of equality, inclusion. No, it is extremely against, opposed to that propaganda, which is coming from the globalist mindset. I really am so happy that you raised that objection, because I don't want people to go away with the wrong impression. I absolutely am one of the biggest warriors fighting against universalism, you know, that's around, as far as I know. Hate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's despicable.
Rob, do you have anything to add on this at all?
No, I'm kind of a bit awestruck about some of the things we've been talking about to tonight, and wow, it's just, it went deep.
Yeah,
it's funny. Very, very deep, and just absolutely brilliant. Like, my little mind is fizzling away here. very inspired by the conversation.
I'm really happy that you say that, because it is deep. It starts deep. You know, one of the things I say when I teach the Living Gnosis today is, or when I teach Planetary Tantra, and I've made a beautiful merge of Tantra and Gnosis, by the way, which is unique and never happened before. I say, look, in this teaching, we immediately go to the depths and we immediately take it from the top. It's extremely intense. There's no gradation. There's no hierarchy. There's no, well, I'll teach you this now, and if you learn that, I'll teach you something else tomorrow. We go to the core.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to understand where, go ahead.
No. Go on. Finish, please, John.
Well, one thing that's important, if anyone is interested, after hearing me blow off in my usual arrogant and grandiose manner, if anyone is interested in putting me aside and knowing what the truth is, then you go to sophianicmyth.org, and there is a 4-minute clip that explains the Sophianic narrative. Just 4 minutes, a beautiful narration and a montage of images. And if you choose to subscribe, you can receive the full Sophianic Myth, chapter by chapter, the 9 episodes of it. I think they're sent out once every 5 days or something. So there's an opportunity, apart from reading it in the book, there's an opportunity to learn what the myth is. And I want to point out that when you go to that page, Sophianic Myth, you'll see that there is an orientation talk, which is really important. And there's the text of the orientation talk. And in that text, I describe this issue of the indigenous lore and mythology of the Irish, Welsh, Basque, Germanic peoples, all the indigenous peoples of Europe, being in such a jumbled and incoherent condition due to having been so brutally attacked. And then I say that the Sophianic Myth is the way to reconfigure them, today, and bring them forward, not just go back to the ancient ways, but bring those ancient ways forward so that we can meet and overcome this horrific transhumanist agenda.
Mm. If I could just briefly offer my take on that last point on universalism. I think it's important to point out, firstly, that there is such a thing as a wider Indo-European tradition, and that Gnostic lore belongs to it. And I think that's something that a lot of people who are new to Gnosticism, that will surprise them. A lot of people will have the misunderstanding that the Gnostic texts come from outside of the Indo-European tradition, that they are Semitic, or they are, you know, Arabic or North African or whatever. They come from the Indo-European tradition. So that's a really important thing to point out.
And they are anti-Semitic. And I've explained what it means to be anti-Semitic in a talk that I've done.
Yeah.
See, Semitic is not a racial designation. So if you are accused of being anti-Semitic, and the people who make that accusation, who condemn you for that, are using the term incorrectly, because it's not racial, it's a linguistic definition.
Yeah.
So the Semitic peoples of the ancient Middle East, who were not the founders of Gnosis, identified themselves by speaking three languages, which are Hebrew, Arabic, and Aramaic. Those are the Semitic languages. And I have said openly, yeah, I am really anti-Semitic. Why? Because I am opposed to the ideology that comes into the world through those three languages.
The supremacist ideology that comes in.
Racial supremacist ideology,
yeah.
Which is Hebrew. The ideology of enslavement and submission, which is Muslim. And the ideology of the Christian savior, Messiah, which is just another version of Judaism, which is Aramaic. Because if any Jesus figure existed, it was in the linguistic culture that spoke Aramaic. Those three languages are encoded with malware, and everything, and I mean everything, that has come into the world through the Semitic languages is to the advantage of the archons. So yeah, I am against those languages.
There's an interesting quote which I noted down that I thought might be relevant at some point, which is there was a professor of Jewish mysticism called Gershom Scholem.
Yeah, I know
him.
You
probably
well.
Know it, right? Yeah. And he once described Gnosticism as the greatest case of metaphysical anti-Semitism.
Did he?
So he did. He did. And so there you go. Anyone who thinks that Gnosticism is somehow from the Judaic tradition, you're wrong.
That's absolutely true. And there are, by the way, this is another problem. An intelligent person sincerely seeking the truth, you know, is looking at books on Gnosticism on Amazon or in a bookstore, if bookstores still exist. And yeah, you're going to fall across books by authors like Pearson, who argue that Gnosticism was a Jewish product. And if that's the first book you read on Gnosticism, it's very unfortunate for you,
yeah,
because you're being misled, you say. I have had to work through this stuff. I mean, sorting out all this stuff and getting to the core message of Gnosticism took all my life. You know, not in his image, didn't come out until I was like 61, you know.
Well, unless either of you have got any leftover points that you'd like to make, which I'd gladly sit and listen to, then I think we're done there for this conversation. And yeah, like Rob, it blew my mind. It was brilliant. And I'm really grateful to both of you for making time for doing this. And maybe we can do another one sometime.
Certainly. Let's see if that we three witches sitting around the cauldron have stirred up a brew, and maybe the aromas and the fumes of that brew will go out and reach our pagan and heathen allies out there. I would deeply wish that to be the case.
Yes, so would I. Yeah, brilliant.
Well, thank you both. Yeah. And we will do some more sometime later. I would love it.
Thank you so much, John.
Yeah, the feeling from this, Dan and John, is like this. You've just opened up a whole world of discussion here, and it's great. Very positive.
Yeah, thank you
so much for being involved.
Thank you,
Rob.
Thank
you both. Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Nighty-night.
For more information about John's work, visit his Odyssey or YouTube channels under his full name, John Lamb Lash, as well as his online school, nemeta.org, nemeta.org. Not in His Image and other of his books are available from most good retailers. If you'd like to hear more from Rob, you can listen back to the two conversations he and I have had on the Fergan Odyssey and YouTube channels. His music and lyrics for Tau Cross are also both enjoyable and insightful. This podcast has its home at fergen.com, fyrgen.com, and my most active channel can be found on the Telegram app. Last but not least, it's time for the riddle section. So for those who are unfamiliar with the Fergan podcast, each episode I read out a riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book, a collection of Old English riddles. Last episode was number 7, and the answer to that riddle was a swan. Now, I suppose this is given away somewhat by certain clues in lines such as to ruffle the waters, or my white pinions, or even a travelling spirit, as our ancestors would have seen swans as being somewhat ethereal, sacred animals. So it's not such an obvious one, but it's, as with many of these riddles, once you know the answer, it does seem quite obvious. So the next riddle, riddle number 8 for episode number 8, is as follows. I've one mouth but many voices. I dissemble and often change my tune. I declaim my deathless melodies. I don't desist from my refrain. Aged evening songster, I entertain men in their homes by rehearsing my whole repertoire. They sit, bowed down, quiet in their houses. Guess my name, I who mimic the jester's japes, as loudly as I can, and rejoice men with choicest songs in various voices. That's all for this episode of the Fergan Podcast, and I hope to be speaking to you all again in the next episode. Be well until then.